WFSU-FM now presents A Visit to the Village Square. This program was recorded at Tallahassee's St. John's Episcopal Church on January 27, 2015.
I'm Liz Joyner. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, I'd like to welcome you to American Values in the Age of Hyperpartisanship, a special evening with David Blankenhorn. Tonight's program is the second in this year's Dinner at the Square series, Us versus Them. We'd like to sincerely thank our sponsor and neighbor, Capital City Bank. Without their generous support, tonight's program would not have been possible. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's facilitator, Bill Maddox. Bill, you can start your way up here onto the stage while I yammer on about you. Bill is an award-winning writer who serves on the board of contributors of USA Today and has also appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and a number of other leading publications. A registered independent who hates politics but loves ideas. He serves on the Village Square Board of Directors, works especially with our Teen Square program, who has helped here tonight. Thank you, Teen Square, and Faith Food Friday projects. Bill is a resident fellow at James Madison Institute, a member of the Holocaust Education Resource Council, a member of the Tallahassee Civil Rights Landmark Committee, and a former KCCI catalyst, and one of the people in Tallahassee I respect the most. Bill.
Thank you, Liz. Tonight we really do have a special treat, and it's not just because he went through heroic efforts to come here, and we are so thankful that he did that, but David Blankenhorn is someone that I have known for, 25 plus years, and is one of the people in this space where we are talking about questions about how to resolve differences and to work together that I most respect. He's been really a mentor and a friend to me for many years. David is an award-winning New York Times best-selling author, has written a number of books and collaborated on many others. He heads a think tank in Manhattan called the Institute for American Values, has been there for, 25, 30 years now. And what is really interesting about his think tank is that it has this penchant for bringing together people who you wouldn't normally expect to break bread and share ideas with one another. David is enormously gifted in a lot of different ways, but one of the things that I most appreciate about him, and I think you will, is that he has an uncanny knack for bringing together people and helping them find common ground, work through differences, find areas of agreement. So he's just an all-around good guy and a friend, and I think someone that you'll enjoy hearing from tonight. So without further ado, I'll ask David to come and join me on stage.
After that introduction, we should just stop now.
All right, so 25 plus years or so ago, I was a 20-something newcomer to Washington, D.C., trying to make my way in the city. I had worked for a Democratic senator from Georgia, Sam Nunn, that many of you probably know. And one day I get an invitation to an event that's being held at the Children's Defense Fund, and it's being sponsored by a guy named David Blankenhorn and his group, the Institute for American Values. I had heard nothing, or knew nothing about any of these people, but was delighted to get this invitation and found the topic and discussion intriguing. And so I go and I listen intently to the conversation. And then afterwards, I make the mistake of approaching one of the speakers. And so I'm now going to let David, we're just going to go ahead and get it out of the way right off the bat. I'm going to now let you tell the Leave It to Beaver story.
All right. So there was a woman on the panel, and she was just filled with intensity. And at the time, I don't know if you remember this, but at the time, if you wanted to make fun of tradition or the traditional family, you would say, well, this is not the days of Leave It to Beaver. Or sometimes you would use the term Ozzie and Harriet. You would say, this is not Ozzie and Harriet, you know. And this woman would say, after all, Leave It to Beaver was not a documentary. This was, Bill was just sitting there the whole time. And at the end of the thing, he walked up to her and said, in this kind of sweet Southern thing, he said, "Well, gee, I really respect a lot of things you said, but I just really didn't like you criticizing the beaver." It was great, and the tension broke, you know, because she was saying, "Oh, gosh." And I felt the same way about the whole thing, you know. I liked the show, and it was an old show even then. And so anyway, that's how we met.
Well, you can imagine she was rolling her eyes, but out of the corner of my eye, I caught David's attention, and I had not yet spoken to him. But after that, I realized that I had at least a potential friend, and so we struck up a conversation, and from there have gone on over the course of the last 25 years to collaborate on a number of things. We did some really fun focus groups. I don't know if you remember this, back in Baltimore,
right,
with Barbara Defoe Whitehead.
Right.
Have spoken on some panels together at various events and whatnot. He's been very generous in inviting me to any number of different conferences and programs that he's held in New York City. And as I mentioned, David is really in some ways kind of a big brother type or mentor of sorts to me. So basically what I thought we would do to begin tonight's program is to test and see just how well David has taught me. Okay, so we're sitting here. Liz has given us kind of parlor furniture. So we're going to play an old parlor game called 20 Questions. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to first ask David a set of 10 questions. And mind you, he has not seen these questions. I debated the whole time for the last several months as we've been preparing for this evening. I debated whether I should share these with him. And finally, this afternoon, when we got together after he got into town, I said, "Here, I want you to see the questions so that you won't be caught off guard." He was like, nope, I don't want to see them. So I'm going to ask him a set of 10 different questions, and his responsibility will be to answer the way he thinks I would say that he would answer, okay? And so we'll just see how well he has taught me, and we'll go through these questions. And I think what this will do is this will give you guys a sense of the terrain that we hope to cover this evening. We'll go back through these 10 questions a second time, and we'll give David an opportunity to explain his answer. Because the first time through, the only thing you get to do is to answer either correctly, in which case I will be happy to give you or incorrectly. So I hope that you do well here, David. All right, the first question, and by the way, you can follow along with the PowerPoint presentation here. Okay, so what we're going to do, this gives you an opportunity to follow along as we go. And so here's our first question, David. Most political disagreements represent a clash between what? Between competing goods and between good and evil?
Competing goods.
Which of the following statements is more likely to arise from polarized thinking? What you say is wrong? You're so personally flawed that you have no business saying anything at all.
You're so personally flawed, you have no business saying anything at all.
Okay, at this point, I need to pause and give a little advertisement here and really a thank you. Nathan Morse, where are you? In the house, back here. Nathan Morse is a high school senior at Lincoln High School. He's part of our Teen Square group, and he helped me put together the PowerPoint presentation for tonight's program, and I thought did a magnificent job of finding I asked for Teen Square assistance, as I'm sure most of you know, because I am a technological Neanderthal, know nothing about how to use technology. But I also wanted to acquaint my younger friends with recording artists like Simon and Garfunkel, and I thought Nathan chose an especially good picture of Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel here. All right, so here's your question, David. Number 3, which Simon and Garfunkel activity represents a better use of time for an engaged citizen? Sitting on a sofa on a Sunday afternoon or going to a candidate's debate?
Going to a candidate's debate.
Eh.
I can't remember the damn song. I remember the one about the candidates debate, but I don't remember the song that the first one came from.
All right, here we go. Which is more important in resolving political disagreements and building political consensus? Good facts or good propositions?
Propositions.
All right. During the 1980s, why did public urination on New York City streets become a serious problem? Was it because no one listened to their grandmothers or because Reagan closed down all the bathrooms?
No one listened to their grandmothers.
Don't you like this trip down memory lane?
This is really a backstory here.
We'll give you a chance to tell it. If we want today's third graders, to become card-carrying members of the Village Square someday, what character trait should we especially seek to cultivate in them? Empathy or modesty?
Empathy.
Modesty is kind of close, but
modesty's okay. Good.
Yeah,
but
we'll talk more. Okay, if Alexis de Tocqueville were alive today, which of Joseph and Rose Kennedy's children would he say contributed the most to democracy in America? John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, or Teddy Kennedy?
Eunice Kennedy Shriver.
I'm so glad you said that. Okay, which of the following... Okay, by the way, for those of you who don't know, David, though he lives now in Manhattan, grew up in Jackson, Mississippi. So we'll find out more about Jackson in just a minute. Which of the following state capitals is more like George Bailey's idyllic hometown, Bedford Falls? Tallahassee, Florida, where you are today, or Jackson, Mississippi, where you grew up?
Tallahassee.
Okay. Over the course of a lifetime, how much will a thrifty person spend? More than the average person or less than the average person?
More than the average person.
And finally, my favorite question of all. According to the Village Voice, what was Kurt Cobain's all-time favorite sitcom?
Leave It to Beaver. So, all right. I think it's time we had a talk with the boys.
All right. So that was very good. You did very nicely. It looks like I've learned more than I probably should have from you. But let's go back through these now and take them one at a time if we can and give you an opportunity to explain more in a more serious way about some of the things that these questions have raised. The first one was, most political disagreements represent a clash between what? Between competing goods or between good and evil? You said competing goods. So help us understand, because this in many ways is kind of the essence, is it not, of hyperpartisanship, that we come to many of the questions that we debate in our day imagining that this is a conflict between good and evil, and yet you're suggesting that what we really ought to do is to see them as competing goods. Help us understand this.
Well, I love the quote by Solzhenitsyn, who said that the line between good and evil doesn't run between you and me, but through the center of every human heart. Mm. So it's not usually when we're arguing about these questions, it's not so much that you're on one side and I'm on another, is so much as that we're internally conflicted. We have doubts inside ourselves about it. And so there's an internal issue of the culture war. But also, it's, I think, not recognized as much as it should be in today's hyper-partisan discussion. But also, more broadly, if you think that the argument is between the right and the wrong, the good and the bad, then that's one way of seeing it. And if I have the right answer, and let's say you have the wrong answer, what is my relationship to you? I should probably try to give you the facts so that you'd be more, I should give you more information so that I could bring you around to the correct point of view. Maybe I should make you feel ashamed for being stupid and not knowing the correct answer or something. You know, but really, the way I think it's more, the way the world really is that usually your argument represents a good. You're standing for a good. You have a good. There's something good about what you're saying, and there's something good about what I'm saying, and those things are in tension with one another. So it's not that you're advocating this evil position, and I'm advocating the virtuous position. You have an argument about a good. I have an argument about a good. They're in conflict. You know, you want to be strict with lawbreakers. You lock them up and put them in jail. Why? Because you believe in justice. You believe in keeping people, criminals off the street. These are good things. I want maybe to be more lenient because I believe in the power of forgiveness and, you know, people changing their ways and so forth. These are good values, forgiveness and second chances and so on. So it's not like, so I think that to me, maybe at the very heart of at least how I try to think about public discussion is that we today, if you turn on the TV or you listen to the public discussion or you listen to the politicians talk, you would think that it's a conflict between the good and the bad, the right and the wrong. I'm fighting for this and these people are fighting to make America worse. Whereas really, in reality, they're competing goods that are in tension with one another, and it requires careful engagement to sort that out.
All right, let me tease this out further, because this is interesting. But surely you're not suggesting that all public questions represent a clash between ideas or propositions that are equally good, are you? And are you suggesting, conversely, that there is never a conflict between good and evil, and that it's always a situation where we're faced with competing goods?
No, it's not always a situation, but it's usually a situation.
Okay.
I was involved in the whole debate about gay marriage, and I came to believe that on the one hand, there was this desire for, on the part of gay and lesbian people, to be accepted as full members of the community. And on the other hand, was this desire to preserve the traditional form of marriage in the interest of children and in the interest of the good that this traditional form was doing. And I believed and still believe that both of those are good things. Those are good. Both of those are good ideas. Now, how one reconciles them is difficult, and it requires hard work. But would there be an example of a totally black and white situation? Well, you know, sure, there are examples of that one could think of, violent acts against other people or horrible forms of bigotry and prejudice. Of course, there are evil exists. I mean, I believe in original sin and evil and all that. But I think we'd be a lot better off if we saw the public discussion as arguments more between competing goods than of right versus wrong. The famous philosopher who said this better than anyone else is a guy named Isaiah Berlin. And he had a tremendous influence on my life. And he writes about this over and over again. So if you want to get the philosopher on this, it's Berlin.
It strikes me.
And by the way, this is one of the differences, I think, between liberalism and conservatism as political philosophies.
Okay.
Liberalism, at its best, embraces the tension of goods in conflict. Conservatism tends to be more believing that there is a hierarchy that's all coherent.
But would you not concede that there is, in the quest for trying to resolve these kinds of difficult questions, ultimately an attempt to try to value or to recognize that one good may have greater value in a particular situation than another?
Sure. Well, that's the debate. Yeah. My friend here wants to lock him up and throw away the key. I want to, let people out of jail. So we have an argument. We have a discussion about this, and we each have facts to bring. But it's not like either one of us is arguing for something evil. That's really my only point.
One of the things that strikes me as I'm listening to you is that there even could be examples where one thinks of the public conflict as a clash between good and evil, where it is nevertheless useful to put this principle into practice. And let me give you an example and tell me if you think this fits. With the question of abortion, there would be many people on the pro-life side who would see that issue as a clash between good and evil. And they would say in their minds that abortion is murder and murder is evil. Okay? But it strikes me that even if one holds that view, it is nevertheless useful to at least consider the possibility of competing goods in this sense. That if you say to yourself, what is it, if I am a pro-lifer, what is it that my opponents are seeking to do? And the answer would be, well, they're seeking to represent the interests of the woman. And they have a concern for her well-being. And it strikes me that even if one holds true to their belief that abortion is evil, they nevertheless ought to be cultivating a concern for that woman just as the pro-choice person would. Is that a fair understanding?
Yes. That's why empathy is more important than modesty,
okay,
by the way.
Save that because we're going to get there in just a minute. All right, but let's go to this next question where we ask, which of the following statements is more likely to arise from polarized thinking? What you say is wrong, or you're so personally flawed that you have no business saying anything at all. This was taken, as you probably recognize, from a recent column that you wrote that I saw, and I'm just kind of curious to get your kind of comment on the state of public discourse, and why is it that we have gravitated so quickly to this notion that some people just have no business even having a voice in the public discussion because they're so personally flawed that they have no business saying anything at all.
It struck me like a thunderbolt because when you go home tonight and you start watching what people say on TV and so forth, just see if you don't see this. More and more, it will not be simply your idea is wrong because of ABC. It will be you are wrong. In your person, you are wrong. You weren't born in this country. You aren't a citizen. I had a friend, Michael Ignatieff, who was a politician in Canada, and he had been teaching in the U.S. for many years, and he went back to Canada. He became leader of the Liberal Party in Canada, ran for and lost the election. And one of the reasons he lost was because they ran ads against him, and the ads just said one thing. It said, Michael Ignatieff, just visiting. Very devastating. Playing upon the fact that he had not lived in Canada for many years. He was teaching in the U.S. And he told me, it wasn't that they were disagreeing with my ideas. They said, I have no business being here at all. Now, if you go home, I just see if this is not right. More and more, this is what we see. It's not just your ideas are wrong. You have no, you shouldn't even be on the platform. You have, you're a crook. Your children are messed up. There's something wrong about you as a person that makes you, why are you even saying anything, is now the charge. And I had a personal experience with this. I testified at one of the famous marriage trials in California, the so-called Prop 8 case in California. I was an expert witness. And I'll tell you, if you want an interesting experience, you do something like that and you see what people say about you. No one said, I disagree with this guy Blankenhorn because of A and B and C. I mean, literally, no one said that. But thousands of people at blogs and newspapers and TV said, this is a terrible person. He doesn't have qualifications. He cheats. He's a terrible, you know, just in other words, you deny them standing personally. And I think it's a terrible tendency in our politics today. And we should make an effort. Whenever we see that, we should just say, hey, no, that's not right. Back to the ideas.
And by the way, this is something that I suspect may be easier for us to do here in Tallahassee than it might be for you in New York, just given the size of the communities and the familiarity that we have with people. And we'll get to that in just a little bit when we talk about idyllic towns and Bedford Falls and your fascination with It's a Wonderful Life. But I want to turn now to the Simon and Garfunkel question, which, by the way, was the only question that you answered incorrectly.
I told you, I can't remember the... Right. Explain this
okay,
to
so
me.
Here was the question. Which Simon and Garfunkel activity represents a better use of time for an engaged citizen? Sitting on a sofa on a Sunday afternoon, admittedly, wasn't...
Was that Mrs. Robinson?
This is all from Mrs. Robinson.
Oh.
Okay? Sitting on a sofa, admittedly, was not a really great discussion or description of civic engagement. So I don't fault you for answering that. But I was surprised to hear you say, going to a candidate's debate.
I was worried about that.
Because I have heard you wax... eloquently
about debates
and about how horrible
I hate debates.
So please, I don't
yeah, but
want
you're
to,
just sitting on a I, sofa like watching Leave It to Beaver reruns. I mean
I don't want to have a debate about this, but tell us why you have so little confidence in debates as a means of helping to engender greater public understanding and consensus.
Because
and
that's
why
all we...
and why you have in your own work often charted a different path. And describe for us how you have gone about setting up different conferences or programs that you've done that don't look anything like a debate.
Yeah, we try to do anything but debates. Debates are what got us into this mess. I mean, all we do is debate. You know, you take a position, you defend your position, no matter what, come hell or high water, you're just on your side. No, debates are part of the problem. We need less debate. Richard Newhouse used to say that it takes a lot of work to achieve disagreement. I really love that. It takes a lot of work to achieve disagreement. If I'm disagreeing with you about something, it's easy just to say, oh, you know, here's my position and it's different than your position. But if we really want to achieve disagreement at the level of genuine integrity, we have to really engage one another. And part of knowing what we disagree about is clarifying what we agree about. We have to start with that. And it requires work. It requires both of us to put a positive effort into working together to figure out what we agree about and what we don't agree about. And it requires engagement and effort. And debate keeps you from achieving that goal by definition. Because debate just means that whatever you say, I'm going to try to rebut it. So debate prevents you from achieving disagreement. And what I think we need more of is that latter part of where we're actually trying not just to station identification or making declarations or taking a pose for the camera or strutting around, you know, taking a position, but actually achieving disagreement in this serious way. That involves, first and foremost, collaborating together in a joint activity
So there's no straw men in the room. They're actually, it's just me and you, right? And we in part of knowing where we disagree, it has to be built on the foundation of knowing where we agree. And often that you find that there's more in common than you might have thought when you begin the discussion, especially if I get to know you personally a little bit in the discussion. So that's why I think debates are the problem, not the solution. At the Institute, where the organization I run, we never have debates. We never have panel discussions where there's three different points of view. We always try to sit in a, you know, circle, and we try to have conversation where we achieve disagreement. We say we put a proposition on the table. So somebody says, okay, here's the thesis that we're going to discuss. And then we discuss it in that way. I think any time we get away from the kind of crossfire, that kind of crap you see on TV all the time, where this person has that point of view, that person has another point of view, you just got to throw all that out the window, because all that does is get us into trouble. And you have to come up with, new models, really. And one reason I'm really happy to be here is because I believe that what you're doing here is such a new model.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. I appreciate the plug. I want to be sure. I mean, I want to be sure that you're able to respond to a potential criticism that I can imagine arising, where someone's saying, "Okay, so this guy says he's not sure about good and evil; it's all competing goods, and doesn't really want to have debates because somebody might get their feelings hurt, and just wants them to all sit around in a circle and sing Kumbaya." You're not suggesting that we surrender strong positions, or that we acknowledge disagreements, or that we always strive to try to cut differences and never hold to moral propositions. You're just simply saying that there's a manner that goes about this. And so I'm curious to give, I want to give you a chance to respond to criticisms that might come that way, but I especially want you to then help us understand beyond the Village Square. Other models, you mentioned crossfire. Are there models from morning TV or elsewhere that you can think of that might be more like what you want to see happen than the debate format that we so often see? What do you think, for example, of Morning Joe there in your backyard?
I think they do a pretty good job, more than most shows, because of Joe and Mika, two different political parties, they actually listen to one another, and they try to have a conversation. So that's my favorite morning show. But most of the TV and most political discussion goes in a somewhat different direction these days.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Which is more important in resolving political disagreements and building public consensus, good facts or good propositions? Not surprisingly, given the name of your longtime publication, Propositions, you answered good propositions. I trust you're not suggesting in any way that facts aren't important, but I think I remember you once saying facts are overrated.
Well, we're awash in facts. I mean, facts are just, most people... You know, there's just facts are everywhere, and the belief that somehow the person who's in possession of the most number of facts is the person who knows the most is completely wrong. I mean, just think of your own life, right? We all know people who are just full of factual information who couldn't walk in out of the rain. So the idea that somehow the facts by themselves are dispositive on important discussions. Let's just call them necessary but not sufficient. Because every question you ask, there's a wonderful philosopher, I forget who said this. He said, the worst sin is to ask the question poorly. That's great. The best way to have a discussion is to ask the question well. Not to say everybody present the facts, but you have your facts, I have my facts, and we're just going to trade facts, because that's not going to get us very far. And you're really not going to get very far talking to people who believe that somehow this is all going to be settled by comparing the facts. Facts are important. Don't get me wrong. Of course they're important. And there is an objective reality out there, and trying to understand it, and data, and all these things are important. But given us humans, given how we think, given how we live in social groups, asking the question well is the best starting point for something powerful to happen. And that's why I say propositions. That's just another way of saying, what's the question that we find interesting that we can work on together? Because then we're involved in a collaborative effort to answer a question. Will facts be brought to bear? Sure they will. Sure, people are going to bring up facts. Facts are good in their place. But the most important thing to do is to figure out the question that we all agree is important.
Okay. Very good. All right, I want to get to one of my favorite questions that, again, takes us down memory lane. During the 80s, why did public urination on New York streets become a serious problem? And you answered correctly that it was not because Reagan closed down all the bathrooms, but because no one listened to their grandmothers. Explain that whole story and some of the writings that you did back then about this phenomenon.
Well, this was a long time ago. I don't know if you all even remember this, but there was a time, I think this was in the late 80s, there was a time when there was some kind of concern that, you know, people were urinating in the streets. And some people wrote, it was in California, some cities in California, and somebody said, well, it's because of President Reagan, because there's no more public accommodations. And so what are people going to do? And so I was young and full of beans, and I wrote an article for the Los Angeles Times that said, look, you know, President Reagan may be a terrible guy, but he cannot make me pee in the streets. Only I can do that. And so I thought, you know, it was more just, you know, that the values we have as a culture and a society and as individuals are more important than whether or not there's a nearby toilet. I think I might have shifted in the years since I wrote that. I still believe basically the same thing, but I might give a little weight now to more of the importance of, yes, because living in New York City now, it is very important to have access to the facilities. But ultimately, whether or not, I think I was just trying to take a shot at people who just wanted to blame a politician for a social behavior. You know,
well, this is what I was hoping that you would pull out of that story, is just because it seems so common in our day and so familiar that no matter what the problem is, those that are critics of the president or those that are critics of the governor
just blame him.
Yeah, just blame him.
And sometimes it's us. Sometimes it's us. It's we, the people, you know, who are doing this. So
good. All right, now I want to get to this third grade question. If we want today's third graders to become card-carrying members of the Village Square someday, what character trait should we especially seek to cultivate in them? You correctly answered empathy. And it reminded me of an article that you wrote about an experience that happened to you when you were in third grade in Jackson, Mississippi. Tell us that story and then why it inspired you now to make a public plea for greater empathy.
Oh, I'm in the third grade. It's 1963, and the schools in Jackson, Mississippi had an essay contest for third graders, and the topic was helping others. And I worked so hard on this essay called Helping Others, and my essay won. I won the essay contest. And I said that you should always help other people, even if they were different from you, and you should try to make everybody your friend and not just play with certain people, and you share your toys with them. And just because they may look different than you and talk different from you doesn't mean that you shouldn't make them all your friends. And this won the essay contest, and wasn't I proud? And my parents were proud, and they got a letter from the school board. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Blankenhorn, each semester a student from the white schools is chosen to have his essay exhibited at the
at downtown at the central office. And they were so proud, and I was so proud. And it was only later that I looked at that letter, and I just, this was just the white students. Mississippi, Jackson schools were half African-American at the time. So make them all your friends.
But it was segregated schools. That you weren't mixed at this point.
Oh, this was during the era of segregation.
Yeah, yeah,
these
yeah.
were the white schools. These were just the white schools that participated in this contest. So then I'm thinking, well, then as an older child and as an adult, I'm thinking, well, golly, you know, make them all your friends. Does it matter if they look different or talk different than you? And I won the prize, you know. But then what a kind of falseness in the whole thing, right? Because it was the opposite. It was the opposite of helping others. It was the opposite of we're all in this together, you know, to have this system where only the white children even got to compete. But at the time, as just a little kid, you know, this just kind of passed me by. So it just seemed so ironic, I mean, or just weird that this would happen to me. And especially since I was so proud of having been so empathetic in my essay. So I still think about that. And I think that the politician, I've been lately on a spree of reading books about Lincoln. You know, Southerners really were interested in the Civil War. So Lincoln, I think one of his most profound qualities was empathy. I really think that's true. I mean, so I just think the idea that you can sincerely put yourself in the other person's shoes, not just as an intellectual matter, but really feel it at a deep level. You can feel how they feel about something. That's empathy. Feeling into the other situation. It's incredibly hard. Obviously, I and everybody involved in that essay contest in 1963 egregiously failed the test. But it's a thing we should try to do, because without the quality of empathy, you're much less likely to want to have the kind of engagement. Because otherwise, why bother, really? You know, why not just point out why you're wrong, and that should be enough. You know, just give you a little high-minded lecture that might enlighten you. And that ought to be enough for the evening. But, you know, this other thing, empathy, democracy depends upon the citizens of the democracy having a certain ability to empathize with other citizens, or otherwise the engagement that democracy requires will not take place. And I think today we are in some ways getting to the point where that engagement is simply not taking place. We're just shouting, and just kind of angry shouting, as opposed to actual engagement. And I really worry about this. I don't know. I just think it's a very serious problem. And I think one of the things to do is to prize as a society the value of empathy a bit more.
So your advice to me then, as a husband and a father, is that in the same way, and as a citizen, is then in the same way that I am constantly reminded of my need to empathize with my wife or with my children, that you're suggesting I need to do that with my fellow citizen, perhaps especially those that may have a different perspective or disagree with me, as my wife and children so often do.
Yeah, and that's you know, Bill,
legitimately.
I think that one of the reasons we've been friends is that I see that in you, and I know that you're trying for that, and I admire it, and I, you know,
all right,
I'm saying that it's
Well, I think that is the basis of it in some ways.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned the word democracy, and our next question is my favorite, the Tocqueville question to which you correctly answered Eunice Kennedy Shriver. But before we get to it, I want you to talk a minute about civil society. Because if you go to your website and you look up your organization's mission statement, it has, you know, the phrase civil society, like, held up high, and that your organization is all about promoting civil society. And so I'm interested in hearing you just explain that term and explain why you think it is so important.
Yeah, our mission is to study and strengthen civil society. And by civil society, we mean the parts of life, the relationships, and the institutions that exist between the government and the individual. So if you're just the individual person walking around with your rights and your ideas and your privileges, that's one thing. And if you're the government, the state, that's another thing. But in between, all that thick stuff in between, like people coming to voluntary organizations called Village Square to talk with one another, people going to houses of worship or going to father-daughter pancake breakfasts on Sunday morning, or forming voluntary, what Tocqueville famously called voluntary associations, or getting married, or, you know, forming groups and bonds as citizens that aren't part of the state. The state may have some regulatory influence, but basically it's not something that the state creates, and it's not something that it's just at the individual level. It's all that stuff in between. And the great writers of the American experiment, I would say first and foremost Tocqueville, but also the great writers, liberals and conservatives over the years, have time and time again emphasized this as one of the most remarkable facts about America. Tocqueville famously said, if you want to do something in France, you go to the state. If you want to do something in England, you go to a man of rank. If you want to do something in America, you form an association. It's just great. Just great. So that's the way, you know, we move out west where start new states. We form these, little groups to help survive. So this voluntary acts, these voluntary relationships and groups, it's the stuff of American democracy. It's the kind of lifeblood of our, it occupies most of our lives, right? I mean, if you think about just how you spend your day, how many hours a day, unless you're an elected official, do you spend acting as an agent of the state? And how many times are you just by yourself, just doing solitary? Mostly you're in these relationships that are in this middle stuff. If it's healthy, if these are vibrant relationships, healthy relationships oriented to pro-social goals, you have a good society. You have a diverse society with all kinds of interesting things happening. If you don't have it, you're in trouble. And so, and it's one area where I think a lot of liberals and conservatives can actually agree that this is an important area of society. And it's an area where we may be getting somewhat weaker as a society because we tend to become a little bit more, the associations we join tend to be online associations. These, you know, you send in $20, maybe your membership of a big organization, but to actually come out on a Tuesday night to go to what Robert Putnam calls face-to-face civil society, that's becoming maybe a bit rarer in the U.S., and as the digital world mediates more and more. So it's important, and families, probably the most important institution of civil society, and our families in America are not in the shape that we would, I think, would want them to be in. So three cheers for civil society.
And I guess this in many ways then explains why you share my appreciation for Eunice Kennedy Shriver, because no disrespect to her brothers. I mean, especially, I mean, you could pull out JFK's famous quote of ask not what
ask
you can do
not.
For your country.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a great statement of the importance of civil society and of
Robert
of
Kennedy citizens. Going to speak on the day that Martin Luther King was killed, going to black community. I mean, that was a very hard question.
Or the great RFK quote that, where he talks about our GNP doesn't measure the quality of our poetry and all that beautiful. Right. Nevertheless, Eunice sees a problem and says,
Let's form an association
and let's solve it. And here, after she's gone, and for many years, as far as the eye can see, the Special Olympics is apt to live on.
Global in scope, years and years of decades of patient work, not trying to grab credit. You have to admire this. Yeah. So, it's a hard thing to say, but I think in terms of this, from a civil society point of view, I think you got to give it to her.
Well, and here's what I have. I totally agree with you about the importance of civil society being something that liberals and conservatives ought to be able to agree on. And I guess one of the things that I've observed about Tallahassee, I moved here, as you know, 6-8 years ago or so, and I have just been struck by how rich the civil society is in this community and how commonplace it is for people to get involved in any number of groups and associations. In fact, tonight, our dinner tonight is sponsored by Capital City Bank. And the reason why you were correct in answering that Tallahassee is more like the idyllic Bedford Falls than Jackson is because we have bank presidents that are nothing like Potter from It's a Wonderful Life. And let me give you a couple of illustrations. Several years ago, I volunteered to coach my son's Little League baseball team, not long after I moved to Tallahassee. I had done that for all my older boys. I wanted to do it for him. I show up at the meetings to get my team, and they said, oh, by the way, we've got a young man who wants to assist you, who has no family connections to any of the players on the team, which is common. Most of the teams were coached by dads and stuff. So the bank president's son, who's then 25 years old, of Capital City Bank, signs up and is my volunteer coach for the entire year, has no connection to any of the players. Lo and behold, I look out during the middle of a couple of the games, and the bank president and his wife have come to see a bunch of kids that they don't even know, probably, playing in their Little League game because it's part of their community. At the end of the season, they offer to host a party for all of us to celebrate. Not long after that, I go to Young Actors Theater, where my kids have been involved in musical theater and whatnot. And lo and behold, the guy that's then the head of the board of directors of Young Actors Theater works for a different bank, but he's their board chairman. And as I got to know him and started talking to him, I was like, so how did you get involved with Young Actors? Was one of your kids or nieces or nephews part of? No, they just happened to bank with me, and I got interested in what they were doing, and I now volunteer as their board of directors. Now, I'm willing to bet that if I were to come and visit some of the banks in your town, that Elizabeth Warren is quite quick to talk about, you probably wouldn't see that level of personal engagement in the lives of ordinary people or in the life of a community. Is that fair?
I don't know. You know, I don't know what I answered Tallahassee compared to Jackson because in Jackson the race issue still is too paralyzing. It still has got everything so stymied, you know. And I don't know how you're, I don't know about the race issue here in Tallahassee, but the in Jackson it stopped. You know, it retards a robust civic sphere because everything is still so retreated into segregated worlds. And when you get into a big place like New York City, I just don't know. I mean, we were talking before about what kind of place would Village Square be most successful in, and you were saying that you thought Tallahassee was a was a really good city for a thing like Village Square and what other cities around the country. I mean, it's a good thing. It's actually, it's a great kind of Robert Putnam question. What are the cities or what are the communities in the country where you tend to have a robust civil society? I mean, this is the hallmark of America, so I'm sure there are plenty of places out there where you can find this, but where is it doing the best? Where is it under the most stress? Those are interesting research questions.
I guess the thing that I've observed, just in comparison of this community to, say, Washington, D.C., which is probably more like New York than it is like Tallahassee, is that here, because of the size of the community and because of the rich community life that exists, you find people who probably have, and surely have, significant philosophical, political, religious differences, nevertheless finding some way to find common ground, to enjoy each other as friends, even though they will disagree about very fundamental things. There seems to be a far more of that in this town than I ever remember in a place like D.C., and that I can only imagine. It would just be hard, because there would be such a tendency to kind of gravitate toward those that think like you, and you don't have an opportunity in some of the debate or discussion about ideas to really get to know people beyond just their ideas.
Yeah.
And yeah. I don't know. There's a lot... the role of friendship in knitting community and in helping to bring about civil society, I think, is extremely important.
Yeah.
All right, Liz, you've got some questions for us?
Can we govern our republic without political parties? If so, what does that look like?
Of course, many of the founders were against parties. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't really feel qualified to give a very smart answer to it, though. That's something I guess I'll have to go think about. Parties are getting weaker. We're becoming less loyal to institutions generally, all institutions across the board. Loyalty to parties is declining, along with loyalty to almost all institutions. But whether or not you could really get along without them. See, I'm a big believer. See, if you like civil society, you like authority. You like authoritative institutions. You can't just have everybody running around as, you know, radically disconnected individuals. People need to belong to associations, and political parties are one of them. I don't know, though.
Okay. Liz, you want to give us another?
So in terms of associations, what about the Association of Coke Sponsors in K-O-C-H sponsors in Las Vegas? Is this civil society in action?
I'm sorry, what's...
I guess the Koch brothers is the reference. Is that correct?
The Koch brothers?
Yes.
Well, that is civil society. Sure it is. And... other people on other parties do much the same thing, and I believe that there should be more transparency about this, and also believe in campaign finance regulations. But the donors don't make those rules, or at least not explicitly.
That will have to be the last word for the recorded portion of our program tonight. Dinner at the Square was recorded live at St. John's Episcopal Church in downtown Tallahassee. The Village Square is committed to civil and constructive public dialogue on the issues that matter to our community, our state, and our nation. Find the remainder of tonight's program online at tallahassee.tothevillagesquare.org. Thank you for joining us, and good night.
Join us again next time for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU-FM.